Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today, I'm speaking with Kyle Riesmandel, author of the book Neighborhood of Fear, The Suburban Crisis in American Culture, 1975 to 2001. Kyle, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
And we're glad to have you on our show. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Kyle Riesmandel. I work as a senior university lecturer in the Federated Department of History at NJIT in Rutgers-Newark. In Newark, New Jersey. I'm also a proud New Jerseyan, so I grew up not too far from here. And the genesis of my book really comes from growing up in the North Jersey suburbs of the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So it's kind of a fascinating journey for me to be back working close to where I grew up and also in a place that's so close to my research.
What was it that led you to focus specifically on this suburban crisis that you described? What was it that drew you to it? And why is it a story that is so worth telling?
So what drew me to it in that experience growing up, so I'm a white man. I was raised by college educated parents. I grew up in the suburbs. Most of my neighbors were of a similar demographic and trajectory. And what I saw so much of was people who were afraid, people who were scared, people who were anxious, despite the fact that they had all of this privilege, all of these advantages, some of it earned, some of it inherited, but it was a world of relative ease, right? Compared to lots of other places in the globe and lots of places in the United States in that period. And when I went to graduate school and I was sort of thinking about what I wanted to do with my life and what I wanted to research, you start to get asked these questions like, what's your dissertation about or what do you want to study? I kept coming back to, what was that all about? Like, what was driving that anxiety or that fear? And then as it sort of morphed into a dissertation and a book, the question really became, what were the consequences of those fears? Why did it matter that privileged, largely white people were afraid of things, right? What were they afraid of? Why were they afraid of it? And what consequence did it have for the broader culture and for them? That really drove the purpose of the book. And I think it's important for a couple of reasons. So one, it's understudied, this era of suburban history. So there's been, as you may know, the New Suburban History movement, which kind of culminated in the early 2000s, a bunch of books by like Kevin Cruz and Matt Lasseter and David Freund and others who we're trying to rewrite suburban history to be more inclusive, to think about questions about race and class and gender and sexuality that hadn't really been thought about. And so I sort of built from them to say, what hasn't been thought about in this later period, right? So most of them are writing about immediate post-war suburbs, and so 45 to the early 80s. And I realized no one's writing about or has written about this later period, 75 and up through 9/11. So I think one is thinking about how important the suburbs are to American culture, American politics, we need to understand them. And then two, if you understand the suburbs in that period, you understand the rightward turn in American culture. You understand the rise of Reagan. I think you understand to some degree the 21st century politics of Donald Trump. So I think it's really important to think about how did this happen on the ground? What were the cultural manifestations of this rightward turn? And how did it facilitate the rise of figures like Reagan and Trump? But also how did they facilitate the power of people who were already powerful?
I was thinking as I was reading the book that you do have this very fascinating interplay between this notion of anxiety and the reaction, which is to seek some sort of greater empowerment. And as you make it clear in your book, it is very much a question of individual and local empowerment, that people were really seeking to try to, you know, find solutions in part because they felt that, you know, the ability of larger governing bodies, larger organizations to solve these problems was not there. If anything, they sometimes saw those organizations as the source of the problems. And I thought that came across very well in your chapter about NIMBYism and, mm-hmm. and your focus in that chapter upon the Three Mile Island incident in 1979.
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, because so part of the argument of the book in thinking about, you know, so often what you'll have people say is, so why were they scared? So number one, figuring out why were these threats visible? Why were they seen as dangerous, right? When in an earlier era they were not. And then two, why were they able to react in these ways? Why did suburbanites do these particular things in these ways? And then what does it tell us? So there's a couple of through lines that come together in that chapter. One is the emergence of the environmental movement itself, that we have by the mid-1970s, a pretty successful environmental movement. People who are saying, you know, we passed all of these laws, clean water, clean air, created the EPA, Endangered Species Act, right? So there's sort of an established idea that the environment needs protecting and is actually in danger from people and development. And then you have this second thing, which is the rise of sort of the new right or the new conservatism, you know, eventually embodied by Ronald Reagan, which is the idea that government, right, is not the solution to your problem, it is the problem. And that, you know, to think about how to solve issues in American culture, right, to sort of respond to the malaise of the Jimmy Carter era, we need to empower businesses and we need to empower individuals and families. And so when those two things come together in the mid-70s, they come together at just as people are ready to see environmental danger, they have environmental danger where it didn't exist before, right? So Three Mile Island or Love Canal, these places where suburbanites expected, right, clean, safe, healthy living, but actually got an endangered landscape that they were ready to see as endangered, and they're being told government is not going to help you. You should do it yourself.
And the question is, how do they go about that? What comes across when you're describing that is a theme that seems to recur throughout your book, which is sort of an effort to reinforce the bubble, to basically, you know, push out those threats, even if they didn't identify them first. I mean, it's hard to miss that that you're living next to a nuclear reactor, but it's not until that, you know, threat becomes real. And I like what you do as well in terms of how you tie it to popular culture, how you point out the parallel between the release of the movie China Syndrome just in theaters just a few days before Three Mile Island, and how you have this culture which oftentimes echoes or resonates or shapes how we think about these fears, and then how people in these communities respond to them.
Yes, exactly. And I think this is another thing about studying sort of modern or contemporary American culture writ large, but also particularly the suburbs, is I think you're doing a disservice if you ignore culture and media, right? If you're not thinking about the frameworks that are being provided by things people are consuming every single day, right? The daily newspaper, Time Magazine, the nightly news, what's on the big screen, what's on television at night, and to some degree, subcultures of, like, especially for teenagers and kids, as we'll talk about later, around, you know, comic books or Dungeons and Dragons and these things, that these cultural texts organize knowledge, they organize the world, they provide a way of seeing things. And so, you know, up until 1977, nuclear power was something like 60 to 70% of people supported nuclear power, right? We're in the middle of an oil crisis, we want cheap energy, we're told it's safe and efficient, right? It'll eventually be power too cheap to meter. And then after the China Syndrome comes out, you're like, interesting, here's a way of seeing the nuclear power plant. I think, I can't remember if it's Newsweek or US News says, the nuclear plant is the boogeyman in a doomsday thriller. And 2 weeks later, an actual plant nearly melts down in almost the exact same fashion as the movie. And so people have this, you know, kind of jarring moment, but they're able to understand it now as threatening instead of as a energy savior or a safe to have in their backyard.
And yet what the reaction to something like that, as you point out, is not to turn against nuclear power writ large, although you do describe that you've already mentioned that shift in public opinion, but it's more specifically to push it out of their immediate environment. I mean, the essence of NIMBYism is that they're not necessarily going to say, let's shut down all nuclear power plants. They're simply saying, I don't want nuclear power in my neighborhood. I don't want it anywhere where it could harm my family.
Yes, exactly. And this is part and parcel of sort of the ethic of privatism, right? Is that I'm here to protect my backyard, my family, and to some degree, maybe even my neighborhood from emergent threats, right? That is my sort of primary job. Whether the government will do it or not, I'm here to do it. I don't actually care per se about an ideological commitment to no nukes, right? Which was fairly popular in the 1980s. I don't necessarily care about police reform. I just care that the police have failed me in protecting my children. And so this kind of provincial or local attitude pervades their response to these threats. Because, and part of the important thing about the book is the argument is these threats are now local, right? Rather than seeming exterior or as coming from the outside, such as racial integration or the force of the state to tax you more, these threats are appearing almost randomly within your environment, right? So you're like, whoa, there are kidnappers here. There's a nuclear power plant here. They want to build a trash incinerator in my neighborhood. I can react to that and respond to it in this way that's really about me. Rather than about the sort of ideological entanglements of environmentalism or something else.
I was wondering if you could elaborate a bit upon Three Mile Island and how it serves to embody the spirit of NIMBYism. Because you would think on the surface that NIMBYism would not have a lot of traction. If you're talking about this, you know, this industry, you're talking about this existing infrastructure, this presence that is, you know, nationwide, globally. And yet, as you described, NIMBYism has extraordinary success during this period in terms of defining these local landscapes in ways that preserve, the suburban ideals as the residents have it, oftentimes, as you explain it, the expense of others.
Yeah, so it turns on the core concept of the book, which is productive victimization. So the essential idea is that, one, people have to experience something as real, right? That there is a lived experience of danger or fear or threat that exists that someone can imagine themselves being part of, right? So the China Syndrome and then Three Mile Island allow people to think about a nuclear power plant not as something friendly, safe, or something to ignore, but as an actual real hazard to life and limb. And so that real threat is established, and then it gets sort of reproduced in culture, right? It gets seen in all these other ways, whether it's the failure of government to respond or whether it's a television show or a news broadcast that reinforces this idea. But it then says, okay, this is productive for me because now I have a say in my local land use, right? In this way that I maybe wouldn't have had before, or I only had in sort of limited way in an earlier era. And so it allows you to say, not my backyard becomes a catch-all for environmental threats writ large, right? So environmental in quotes. So it's not just that thing might poison my water, which was very real, Love Canal, but that building a halfway house or a needle exchange or affordable housing is now an environmental threat to my family, right? It's sort of environmental as cultural.
And then you have you have the fascinating consequence of that, which is that, you know, in effect, these events tend to crystallize the thinking of what these threats what form they might take. And then you describe in the aftermath of Three Mile Island, the fate in particular of Shoreham, which is this fascinating episode that I wasn't as familiar with compared to Three Mile Island, where you have the battle against a very, you know, powerful company, very expensive company that has invested a lot in establishing a nuclear power plant that a few years ago people were, you know, happy to see going up, but now are determined never to see go into operation, and they succeed.
Yeah, and the reason I spotlight them in the book is, one, that it is both is about nuclear power, but two, that they really show this commitment to NIMBYism, right? That they successfully oppose this plan. They do so in any number of ways, right? They use their privilege as constituents, right? They're seen as really important voters to both local politicians like the county executive, but also to state politicians like Mario Cuomo. So they want to appease voters like this. They don't want to make them mad, because when they make them mad, as I show in the book, any number of politicians who are for Shoreham get voted out of office, right? Across party lines. So Democrats and Republicans. And so they're really important as constituents, and they flex this muscle at the ballot box. They also say, we're your most important consumers. If you want to continue to operate on Long Island, you continue to want to, you know, get our money, you're going to have to listen to us, right? And they're able to do so because, you know, as I point out, the sort of unintended and sometimes intended effect is people elsewhere who are not as powerful, largely communities of color, particularly Black Americans and Latinx Americans, are not able to do this, right? So they end up with these things in their backyard. And so they're able to push out Shoreham and to prove that this works, right? It's kind of a proof of concept for many of these people. But then they go immediately home. They don't join marches. They're not spending money on anti-nuclear causes, right? They're just happy that it's not there.
So in effect, the battle in their mind is over rather than just simply shifted to a different front.
Exactly. And it provides this way of thinking about, you know, these politics, right? That how can you argue with a homeowner who says, I don't want to endanger my children? How do you argue with the homeowner who says, we don't want to contaminate our water? It's very easy to argue with somebody who has an ideological commitment that nuclear power is in and of itself bad, right? And they understand this politics intuitively. And some of them are sophisticated enough to sort of think that way, and others really are simply scared, right? Three Mile Island is a very real thing to them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
It's also an example where you can, if somebody says nuclear power is bad, you can, you know, argue the case, you can find constituent for it. But if somebody simply says it's a threat in my neighborhood, I don't want it out, I mean, how do you, you can't really argue the merits of nuclear power, because that's never going to work. All you can do in the end is simply move it away or never start it.
Yeah. And the choice becomes, do we, you know, we being the power company, we being the state who's heavily invested in this idea, simply impose our will and leave and take the consequences of that? Or do we recede and find another way, right? Which is to shut down the plant, right? Literally billions of dollars right down the toilet. It's the first plant ever to be built and not opened, right? To not, you know, they go through the entire process of building it, licensing it, and never produces a single watt of energy.
One of the things I thought was interesting, and you've already mentioned it, which was the discrepancy that existed between, you know, on one hand, there was this growing awareness of the environment. There were growing measures on a national level to deal with it, such as the Clean Air and Clean Water Acts. And yet at the same time, how even with these in place, you do have that growing anxiety. And here I'm thinking particularly of Love Canal, because mm-hmm. here you're talking about, unlike, say, Three Mile Island, which was an accident that took place in, you know, 1979, Love Canal was more of this, you know, crisis that was there before the period you're discovering started, the recovering started, you know, it started before the period they're recovering, but it was one that came into view in the mid-1970s and underscored the sense that, you know, this place you move into that seems so bucolic and safe actually is filled with all these you know, poisons and toxins that, you know, make it more hazardous than, say, if you were to be living in the inner city.
Yes, exactly. And so this is, again, part of like the larger argument of the book is that the mid-1970s, I sort of use 1975 in the title, but the mid-1970s marked this shift in suburban history, right? That sort of what we might think of as this uninterrupted period of peace, or at least seeming peace, right? So many scholars have shown how there were any number of environmental or domestic or criminal dangers that were occurring in that period, but they're not visible in culture. They're not sort of the center of the suburban experience, become the center of the suburban experience in this later period. So due to development, particularly industrial development that was done poorly, right, that endangered the environment, like at Love Canal. And so you end up with this period of time where suburbanites are confronted with fears, you know, as I say in the book, environmental, moral, and criminal. And that they all have this kernel of materiality. They all have this kernel of realness, right, that there do seem to be real consequences for families from these threats. And so Love Canal becomes the touch point where, you know, literally they have to close the town down. Everyone has to move out because so many kids, so many people have genetic defects, cancers, strange diseases and disorders no one's ever seen before. This provides a way to say, well, I'm not going to live in another Love Canal. I'm not going to allow this thing to happen. And so from that moment, right, they begin to view their environment much more skeptically and to see danger in many cases where it does not exist.
And it's not just a danger from, say, an environmental disaster. It's a danger that becomes localized to the point where it's literally in the home. And I'm thinking here about your description of chemical sensitivity, which is this, which really emerges during this period where you start to see people identifying it. And it's not something that's caused by a truck overturning and spewing out pesticides or an explosion of a Union Carbide plant, but it's happening because mm-hmm. of the everyday chemicals that people are buying supermarkets and using in their neighborhoods without any real concern.
Yes, and this is, in some ways, this is the most difficult thing to write about in the book, was the idea of everyday chemical or environmental danger being both sort of imaginary or produced at the level of the individual or family, and also being real, right? Experienced as a real material thing in a body, right? That people are sick. They do feel these things. And yet, as you point out, right, there's no single cause you can point to. This moment of burying waste, of a, or as I talk about in the Don DeLillo's White Noise, of like this moment in the book where there's this gas that's released and we can point to this as a real, you know, as a possible explanation for our endangerment. It's people in their own home saying, it's my refrigerator. It's the rubber that my shoes are made out of. It's this, you know, environmental illness or multiple chemical sensitivity that modern life itself is made up of these chemicals and I cannot escape it, right? No matter what I do, there's no safe place to live.
I was thinking about, like, for example, the Alar scare involving apples. How, you know, you don't think of a fruit being, you know, dangerous when you buy it from the store, but then it turns out that there's this chemical on it that's getting people sick, and therefore it's entered, you know, the threat is inside the house and it's making your family sick.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the reason it's included is in part because it was so prevalent as a sort of suburban or middle class disorder, particularly among women. But it also, I think, paves the way towards our sort of consumerist view of health and wellness. A historian, Natalia Petrozella, is working on doing some really fascinating work about wellness culture and where it comes from. And I think a lot of it comes from this idea that I can myself diagnose, treat, and understand my body better than the medical establishment. And I can do it in response to these chemical triggers or these environmental illnesses. And I think paves the way to all kinds of things like the anti-vax movement and other kinds of choices about wellness culture and managing your own body. And yet, right, I still think there is like this materiality or this realness to their pain, to their suffering. And there, of course, as I point out in the book, you know, historical indifference to women's pain, particularly Black women's pain in the medical community, right? So there are all these ways in which there are legitimate reasons to be scared, legitimate reasons to not trust authority, be it the state or the doctors or the police. And yet so much of it feels produced or manufactured, right? That it's actually not any diagnosable thing that can be treated or understood.
And there's also a sense in your book of how it's about basically trying to push back and reclaim what seems to have been lost. So if the body is being poisoned, therefore we must claim, we must, you know, try to find ways to, you know, purify it, remove the threat and reclaim that. And then you go on to say, well, then, and if my house is unsafe, if my neighborhood is unsafe, we must go back and reclaim that. And I'm thinking here about this is a theme that really comes out well in your next chapter, where you're talking about the carceral suburb, you know, the idea of how, you know, that these threats that we went to the suburbs to get away from are now somehow making their way in. And so therefore we now have to not just secure our bodies from chemicals, we have to secure our space from this external threat and you know, make our homes into fortresses.
Yes, and this is, I think, the irony of productive victimization in many ways, is that it does allow for, you know, these legitimate threats and experience them as real and local, allow suburbanites to do lots of things, right? Control space, control people, cement their sort of status as the kind of like default American, right? This white homeowner who is upwardly mobile, et cetera. But they do suffer within this, right? In very real ways. And they are actually limited in many ways. So as you raise this idea of the carceral suburb is in response to crime. And so there's this emergence of the kidnapping threat, which I tell through the story of Adam Walsh and sort of the educational movements that come from that, as well as this emerging notion of home invasion and the bucolic burglary wave, which alerts people to the idea that, oh, even though I moved from the city, people are still trying to get into my house, you know, that's reproduced through all kinds of things like ADT commercials, et cetera. But then ultimately, the reaction is to both more intensely police space as a private individual or as part of neighborhood watch or to buy a home security system or to eventually erect walls and gates in a gated community and employ your own security system or your own security personnel. But you are now living in a jail of your own design, right? So this is what I mean by the carceral suburb. You're both jailer and jailed, right? You're constantly aware of the threat. You're constantly aware that you're in danger, but you're also, mightily trying to exert control over the space in response to that threat.
And it's a space that, as you pointed out, you're trying to control. You're not relying upon these local authorities. You do have a police force. You do have a legal system that, you know, in so many ways, you know, caters to this constituency.
Right. Exactly.
And yet, it's still not enough. We have to spend additional money to put up bars to have either hire private patrols or even, you know, undergo some training and drive around the neighborhood a few hours each week ourselves.
Yes, exactly. And this is, again, sort of when we talk about the rightward turn in American culture, how it's both being fueled by these homeowners, but they're also being facilitated by this broader view that government has failed, right? That the state does not work. And if it does work, it certainly does not work for you, white suburban homeowner. So I talk about in that chapter, and I think it is to some degree woven through the book, but I explicitly explain it in that chapter, which is this foil facilitator relationship between people and the government. That on the one hand, they need as foil to say the government fails, right? And so in this case, the police can't protect our children from kidnappers. They can't protect us from burglars. They don't come when they're called, right? I'm reliant on myself, whether it's gun ownership or alarm system or private security. But I also need them, right? Ultimately, to be successful, to be safe, I need them to respond to my needs immediately, which they do, as you rightly point out, right? So, you know, the book is not necessarily focused on the disparities between urban and suburban or sort of white and people of color, but the differing plights of people who live in cities and who are Black and Latinx, right, shows you that there is this differing relationship to the state, even as white people, even as suburbanites are saying, the state has failed me, right? It's victimized me in some way.
And that's why I thought it was so fascinating, was this idea that the people who you could argue the state was least failing were the ones who perceived that it was most failing them and were doing the most and expending the most to compensate for that perception.
Yes, exactly. So I sort of draw this parallel very briefly, but between, you know, so the response to the kidnapping epidemic in quotes of the early 1980s, right, is to empower parents, is to give them these tools, is to provide all these educational things, have schools and parents and police work together in all these ways. And when there is an actual kidnapping epidemic in Atlanta, the Atlanta child murders, right, the residents of Atlanta, all Black, are treated as criminals. They're treated as suspects. They're treated as outsiders to their own community, right? They are policed actually more forcefully because of it, rather than being empowered to find their children. So you see these, like, you know, disparate parallels across all of these issues.
And I was thinking about how that also plays out in terms of the issue of out-of-control teenagers that you describe, which is a distinct one from this question of the crime rate, because here you're talking not just about this notion of these external actors who are coming in and posing a threat, but you're talking about people within the community who are being corrupted, shall we say, or by culture, by the music, or who and how they, you know, populate the space. You can't expel them from the community because they're members of the community, but they and their presence in the space in the shopping malls, in the community centers, in the schools is seen as great of a threat.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as many scholars have pointed out, you know, very recently, or have done very good work on this, you know, the sort of anxiety about the family and the decline, you know, as I point out in the section on suburban hardcore, right, that Penelope Spheres calls her documentary The Decline of Western Civilization. And it's sort of tongue-in-cheek at some level, but it also captures the anxiety at that moment about the American family, and almost implicitly about the white suburban American family. So what's wrong with our children? And so that anxiety plays out across both sort of popular culture consumption around the occult and Satanism, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and heavy metal. And it plays out around sort of space, right, about where teens are, who they're associating with, and how we think about them, how we regulate them. So their regulation in spaces like the mall and arcade is both endangered, right? Like being there is dangerous to them, but they're also the ones we're worried about, right? We're also worried about them committing crime, drinking, smoking, fighting, shoplifting, etc. And so we get this extension of the sort of security ethic around, you know, kidnapping or burglary gets applied to public space as well, including especially the mall, as well as the rec center and the arcade, where there is a crackdown essentially on the behavior and access of teenagers, right, in those spaces.
It's a perfectly natural, it's perfectly understandable process if you think about it progressively. If you've secured your body and you secured your home, the next thing to do is to secure the community space because you still have to interact there. And especially when you have these kids who aren't, as you described, you know, they aren't staying at home. They're going out. They have to go to school. They want to go play with their friends. And then there are all these threats out there: the older kids, the kids who listen to punk rock, the kids who, you know, heaven forbid, you know, although we'll get to the cultural influence in just a minute, but, you know, play Dungeons and Dragons and who, you know, because of that, they tend to be the bad kids. It's not your kid that's bad, but these bad kids out there who are mm-hmm. who are a threat to your family when the moment they leave the safe space of the home.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, again, sort of the irony, right, of these generation of parents moving to the suburbs to be safe, right? That, well, we can rely on our drinking water, and we can rely on, you know, not having noxious air. We can rely on our house won't be broken into, or our children won't be kidnapped. And we certainly can rely on the idea that our kids can ride their bikes freely around the neighborhood, right? That they are not, we're not worried about what they're going to do or who they're going to encounter. And then suddenly we are, right? Like, and this is, I think, you know, one of the hardest things about writing the book, or the way to construct the book, is how to tell stories that are all happening at the same time, right? So they're in different chapters, and they're around themes and particular responses, or around particular threats and particular responses. But each chapter covers the same period of time, right? So at the same time as Love Canal and Three Mile Island is also the same time as Adam, the same time as Bucolic Burglary Wave, the same time as the Satanic Panic, and the same time as mall rats emerge, right? So they're all part of the same world of fear and the same world of response. So teens really allow businesses, towns, and parents all to kind of work together to really regulate space more effectively for their ends, which is to reconsolidate children into the home because we're worried about them. And what's safer than the house, right? What's safer than the moral environment of consumption of the house where you can play Sega or Nintendo versus going to the arcade, right?
And yet what's fascinating is that what you describe in your last two chapters, which you're talking about, you know, because you're talking about a more localized problem, it's also one that, as you explained, and this comes across especially well in your chapter on culture, but you also talk about it in your chapter about the mall rats, how a lot of that culture is reacting directly to it. You have on that one chapter, I think it's chapter four, you have the picture of from the cover of Out of Vogue. Which is by a punk band Middle Class, and it's almost like they're deliberately pointing their critique not at Western culture or American culture. They're pointing it specifically at suburban middle class culture. It's like a line is being drawn and a war is being declared. And how can you know suburban parents not you know treat it as you know that the peace they're trying to achieve is now under attack.
Yeah, it becomes a cultural phenomenon. So hardcore punk becomes this cultural phenomenon that is suburban, right? It is rooted in the suburbs for so many of those bands and so much of the culture, right? So, of course, you have Washington, D.C. or San Francisco. But if you look at, you know, hardcore L.A., it is about the suburbs. And if I could be so bold, they fucking hate it there. Right? And they articulate this in every possible way, right? The way they look, the zines that they produce, how they talk about themselves and their parents, and to some degree, this is self-hatred as well, right? Mm-hmm. And the music that they play. And so I try to you know construct this world in a way that you understand that it's about how they think about their space and who they are in that space, and that it's very much like these other teens who feel both endangered and dangerous, or surveilled in this way, or not surveilled, who are hailed in this way. But like you know, it's impossible to cover all of hardcore in the amount of time that I talk about it. And there are other books about this, you know. Dora McLeod's book, Kids at the Black Hole, and others, right? But I think there is probably something more to be done about hardcore, but I try to use it to understand there is real rebellion there, right? Mm-hmm. There is real threat, as you point out, to these kids don't like their parents. They are the children of divorce. They don't like the police. They don't like their school. And they are raising their middle finger right in the suburbs, right? They're not just leaving to go to the city to escape. They're playing and performing and confronting their own parents, their own teachers, their own police forces. And so it becomes like this symbol of, you know, teenage rebellion that gets quashed, right? Essentially, that gets regulated out of existence.
I was thinking about how, as I was reading the parallels, you know, with you know the fear of the 1940s, 1950s of communist subversion, the idea that they will somehow, you know, infiltrate the community, you know, brainwash people to buy into their ideology, and that was there. I mean, when you go to a mall and you see kids with mohawks or wearing leather, the sense that, you know, they had succeeded in turning them and, you know, your kid will be next if you don't somehow address this threat.
Yeah, it's not just on TV or on the movie screen. You're seeing these kids in your neighborhood. You've seen a mall rat when you've gone to the mall, right? Mm-hmm. You've seen a kid addicted to Pac-Man. You've seen a mohawk kid. You've seen someone in leather, even if it's just one kid, right? It's a sign of how the culture has shifted beyond your control as a parent or as a local the sort of politician or business owner that you're trying to respond to. So you know, I talk about the changes in mall security and mall rules, you know, quote unquote professionalization. You know, they're still mall cops, right? But they are, you know, employed and trained. They have more technology at their disposal. And you see the ways in which there is a real institutional response to these threats that, like, this is out of control and they need to be controlled as a symbol of, you know, kind of, I think, as you're quite rightly referring to, a nostalgic ideal of the suburb, right? That we have to get back to, you know, Wally and the Beeve, right? We don't need to get back to sort of Henry Rollins.
And yet, one of the things you did in that examination that I really liked was you pointed out the difference between that and, say, dealing with the external threat to the home. Because while these people are perceived as a threat, they're also consumers. I mean, the fact is that these mall rats are going to the mall. They're spending money, and so you mm-hmm. have you describe how it's not just the easy thing to do would be to simply, you know, lock them out to impose curfews. But yeah. at the same time, the people who control the space don't want to push them out to where they lose their money.
Yeah, they have to be regulated, right? And this is really the key. Again, like you compare it to the massive, you know, incarceration of young black men and young Latinx men over the same period of time, right? For the exact same kinds of infractions. You know, hardcore punks were known for walking up to cops and harassing them, trying to beat them up. Mall rats were known for breaking all kinds of laws and rules. And they get a slap on the wrist, right? The regulations of the mall change, but their lives don't change, right? In the same fundamental way that if you are caught lawbreaking in the 80s and 90s in urban places as a teenager, right, you're likely to go to jail, right? You're going to go to Rikers if you're in New York City. And so these disparate outcomes show you just how important those teens are as symbols, right, of the health of the nation, but also as, you know, citizens and consumers in this moment of, you know, what Liz Cohen calls the consumer's republic, that they need to be there and focused on spending, right? Putting quarters in the machine and not fighting, buying clothes, not shoplifting, et cetera.
And of course, it's a lot easier to push back against that threat by going after the music, by going after rock and roll, by going after Dungeons and Dragons, by blaming Marilyn Manson for Columbine as sort of, you know, that, you know, but for that threat, these would be good, you know, clean cut kids.
Yes, exactly. And this is a sort of, the larger implication, especially in that last chapter, of the satanic panic and the logic of the satanic panic. So when Satan sort of subsides by the mid-90s, there's still some real focus on cultural consumption as the locus of problems, right? As the locus of bad kids, dangerous kids, violent kids. And we still operate to some degree under that logic today. But so when school shootings happen, particularly Columbine, there's like, well, what were they playing? What were they listening to? What did they wear, right? Not these kind of more fundamental questions about mental health, family status, you know, structural things, right? And so part of the argument of that chapter really is by focusing on consumption and culture, we ignore the structural concerns that are actually at the heart of teen suicide, teen pregnancy, teen violence, right? That we actually look away as a culture and as a government from all kinds of structural things we can actually do to deal with this, right? That, like, you know, which we know work. I point out quite rightly that just say no fails, right? It is not good at stemming the desire for drugs, because when you treat it as a sort of cultural choice, right, a market choice and not a disease, you end up with lots of people doing drugs, right? So, and it's just one, you know, one instance. I talk a lot about the sort of teen suicide epidemic of the 80s and 90s, and that what we're really worried about is AC/DC or playing a Judas Priest record backward. What we're not worried about is, why are teens depressed? You know, like, what is at the heart of their feelings about themselves? Could it be that their parents are anxious about all the things around them? You know, it's questions like that that there's where I try to put in the context of the rightward turn in culture and politics is by focusing on culture and consumption, we ignore the actual structural concerns that would help everybody, right? So spending on mental health, spending on healthcare itself would help everybody, right? Not just suburban teens.
Hmm. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yes. The what you're working on now question. So I'm a full-time lecturer, so I don't get paid to research. So always what I'm working on now is kind of up to my free time at the moment. So I have two things I want to do. The next book project is sort of tentatively about trying to examine the digital and material worlds together. So trying to break down the wall between how we analyze what people do online and what they do in their real lives. And this is not to say scholars have not done this, but I really do want to sort of cover the same period of time I cover in Neighborhood of Fear to say, what are the connections between your sort of virtual world, particularly in the pre high-speed internet era, and your material world, the ways in which you construct your identity, the ways in which you are addressed by consumer culture, and sort of thinking about, you know, so it all stemmed from sort of early internet culture, like the bulletin board system or BBS, where people are finding a place to be anonymous or to construct an identity online that they then have to grapple with in the real world, right? With so you're often around fan cultures or things like tape trading or, you know, very particular interests, let's say, you know, like Usenet, et cetera, right? So I'm trying to figure out, like, what does that mean? How do we go from a sort of this bifurcation that then becomes merged, and it becomes merged largely through a consumer culture or the commercialization of the internet? So it's a lot of stuff right now, and I haven't had a lot of time to work on it, but I'm really fascinated by the ways in which people navigate the digital and analog world simultaneously, through media and through their consumption and use of media, and how they sort of construct themselves within consumer culture. The second thing is, sorry, I rather said two things. So the other thing was the lost chapter of this book, which I still want to write, which hopefully be a journal article, will be about domestic terrorism. So domestic terrorism sort of being defined in two ways. So the emergence of terrorism as a local threat in suburbs, and this sort of prepares the way for the reaction to 9/11, and domestic terrorism as terrorism within the household amongst family members, and this the glut, I would argue, of media about that threat, and not that it's not real, but that, you know, we have the emergence of Lifetime television for women, and that so many of those films are really focused on the secret threat from within the home. And I think that's actually also part of this age of anxiety that prepares us for the 21st century.
Well, they both sound like fantastic projects, and I look forward to reading that journal article when it comes out and having you back if you can, when you take the first project and turn it into a book.
Yeah, me too. I'll see you in 2035.
Well, Kyle Riesmandel, I look forward to speaking to you about 15 years. Until then, have a wonderful day.
You too. Be well.